Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hello, my wonderful, wonderful, wonderful audience. Undoubtedly, the most acutely intelligent and knowledgeable of any other group in the field of psychology, mental health, anthropology, education, all the fields that pertain to what? To helping human beings, to helping each other. This is the one-year anniversary of my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. It's sold well. It's continuing to sell well. Not yet a bestseller. I'm just hoping that people will really catch on to what that book offers, because it could change a new year. It really, really could. It could help you understand that you don't have to be overcome or even directed, guided, and influenced by guilt or by shame or by anxiety, that you will be a better person and a happier person, more productive and more loving person without it. Book for the first time tells you why you have those emotions. Never before has somebody looked at the biological evolution of guilt, shame, and anxiety. And never before has anyone explained to you what they do as a package, guilt, shame, and anxiety, because they're a package. Other examiners of this issue haven't realized that. And there are simple but hardworking steps to identify and set aside guilt, shame, and anxiety. So you can get it on Amazon. You can order it from me on my website, Bregan.com. It's not just about me that I talk about this book. I wrote this book for you. I wrote this book for people to have both a scientific understanding and a handbook on bettering their lives. A good theme for January. My guest today is Bart Billings, PhD. Bart, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Bart. I'm going to ask three questions of the audience. What do these three things have in common? Jeremy Sears, a soldier, fell through the cracks.
I'm getting a bad reception from you. I don't know if the station could make it more clear.
I'll send them a message. I'm probably coming through clear to them. And I'll just send them a message for you. It says, Bart not hearing well. Jeremy Sears is a soldier who fell through the cracks at the VA and killed himself. Another issue, mass shootings lead to calls for restricting the sale of guns to the so-called mentally ill. Judge approves NFL settlement for TBI, that's traumatic brain injury, and for CTE, that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Judge calls for settlement with the NFL players. Well, one thing all these things have in common is my guest Bart Billings' book, because he addresses all of these issues and many, many more that are really of central importance to many of my listeners, many of us. Bart's book is Invisible Scars, How to Treat Combat Stress and PTSD Without Medication. Bart's a retired colonel. He is in what is called the Military Medical Directorate. Not sure what that means. He's a licensed clinical psychologist. from California, licensed marriage and family therapist. And he's the director and founder of something I've benefited from greatly, the International Military and Civilian Combat Stress Conference. This Combat Stress Conference, which you can find out by Googling civilian, Military and Civilian Combat Stress Conference, or BART links, is the oldest conference of people coming together to talk about military. BART's been running it through thick and thin for many years. I've come a number of times to talk there, even paying my own way because I want to support what he's doing. And BART's the reason that I got to testify before as a key witness, before the U.S. Congressional Committee on Veterans Affairs. I got to testify before them on what drugs are doing to our troops and our veterans, psychiatric drugs. And that was back in around 2010, and I got invited because BART made up his mind to get me invited. BART, are you there, and are you hearing any better?
A little bit, yes, thank you.
Okay. I just got a call from Coast to Coast. I'll probably be on Coast to Coast tonight, where I'm the resident psychiatrist. And that was that interruption I just got. But I'll get back to Coast to Coast after the hour. BART, your new book, when will it be available?
It'll be available through Amazon next Monday, the 18th, and a week later, you'll be able to pick it up on ebook as well as Kindle.
Good, good. Well, your book comes out at a time when it's much needed. That's what binds together all these questions about the VA, their failures to help people, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Because they also come from military machines, politics wanting to focus on that. Maybe we could start with that, BART. What do you think about the politicians calling for scrutinizing the so-called mentally ill more carefully in regard to gun sales? Do you think that's going to do more harm than good?
I didn't hear the first part of that.
Well, the fact we can hear you, by the way, the politicians calling for more gun restriction of sales by focusing on keeping guns out of the hands of people called mentally ill.
I was on a radio show about a week before Chris Kyle, the American Sniper, was killed at a firing range. And matter of fact, that radio show was out of Texas. And I only think what could have been if Chris Kyle heard the show, because the MC on the show asked me point blank, do I believe that veterans who are diagnosed as post-traumatic stress disorder should own firearms and should be able to purchase them or own them. And I am not an anti-gun advocate. I mean, I go to a shooting range myself. But when I gave him the response, he was kind of surprised. I said that I did not feel that anyone who is on a brain-altering psychiatric medication should be allowed to own a firearm, and maybe sometimes not even drive, but because their judgment is impaired. The black box warning on all these psychiatric meds, antidepressants, antipsychotics, basically state that your reasoning and judgment is impaired. The first adverse effect is suicidality. It also says anger and hostility, which translates into homicide. And just about all of the mass shooters were on some type of psychiatric medication. So my response to him was, I don't believe this should be the case. I don't think people who are on brain-altering medications should be allowed to own a firearm, not while they're on these medications. And I gave him an example. It's similar to, you know, having a sports car and going out for dinner, and the person you're with has about four or five drinks, and you're not going to let that person drive your car. They're dangerous because, again, alcohol is mind-altering. Actually, after a day, it gets metabolized and it's out of your system, but psychiatric medications don't, especially when you're on them every day. So what I propose, and now this is a big topic in the media, you hear the president talking about gun control and mental health issues. I don't believe we should focus on gun control. I think what we should focus on is psychiatric medication control, because these aren't mind-altering medications. And what we have to do is similar to what we do for narcotic medications and what we do for somebody who, let's say, has a stroke, has a car accident, and has brain damage. Those instances are reported. Somebody with brain damage, a stroke, it's mandatory for physicians here in California to report that to the Department of Motor Vehicle so they cannot drive their car until they can prove that they're fully recovered and capable of driving. Same thing with narcotic medications. When somebody is prescribed a narcotic medication, they actually go into a database that is accessible by the medical community as well as the police departments. So the systems are already in place, and what I propose is that anyone who was prescribed a mind-altering, brain-altering psychiatric medication that goes to the pharmacist to pick up his prescription, the pharmacist do exactly what he's doing for narcotic prescriptions. He enters it into a database that goes to the Department of Justice or the FBI, and they send out a notice to every facility that sells firearms in the country saying this person should not be on a buy list. They're on a no-buy list. No reason is given because of confidentiality. The only thing that the gun store or sporting goods shop should say to the person is, you're on a no-purchase list. Here's the number, DOJ. You can call them up and they'll tell you why. I feel that proposal would really identify very quickly the core problem in terms of people. A lot of these mass shooters were on psychiatric meds, like I said, just about all of them, but they legally purchased firearms where they, if this system was in place, they wouldn't be able to. And if a family member came in, that would also light up and state to the family member, we can sell you a firearm, but you're responsible to keep it away from this person.
Now, Bart, you're talking as if currently that happens with narcotics, but it does not. There's nothing about, as far as I know, if somebody gets Vicodin for a sore back, they are not. That, there's no alert that goes out about gun control.
Well, if you go to my website, BartPatrickBillings.com, and go under editorials, you will see in California that there's a mechanism in California. Now, I don't know if it's nationally, but I know there is one in California, and I've identified exactly what the law is in California on that person being put into a databank.
Well, we have in New York State a database that, in fact, if I prescribe a narcotic, not even just a narcotic, if I prescribe a benzodiazepine, I have to be part of a New York State database. I have to even go and check to see if my patient has recently had somebody else give him a benzo. I mean, so it's a very great invasion of privacy. But I'm not aware that that is in any way used in regard to getting a gun license. The only thing I've ever heard is that one attempt was made to take a gun license away from somebody in New York State because they were on an SSRI, but it failed.
It's not aware. Even in California, if you're on narcotics, it's not law in California. That does not go to sporting goods stores. What I'm proposing that it should.
That it should. Okay. Well, let's look at that. I mean, there's a couple of big issues there that I have. One is just the overall civil rights issue and privacy issues, which are huge, obviously. The second is the effect it would have on people getting pain meds. Do we want somebody walking around with a lot of pain and rage because they can't get meds, or do we want them on pain meds? I don't think that pain medications actually are associated much with violence unless the person's become addicted and has addict behavior. Pain meds
The only reason I mentioned narcotics is because it is the law in California to record. There's a record of anybody on narcotics. All I'm saying
we
is
have that,
that
here too.
As far as the civil rights question goes, right now in California, people do not have their civil rights when it comes to driving an automobile if they have brain damage. It gets reported. It's mandatory reporting by the physician to the MV saying that this person cannot drive.
I'm not even sure that's the law. So let me bring up another question. We have in this country innumerable people with injured brains. As we get older, we all, in effect, have injured brains. It's a matter of degree. And there's many people walking around with a concussion or two from high school football. The issue, I believe, is not that you report somebody has brain injury to the motor vehicle people. You are bound to report somebody who is too impaired to drive. Bart, that's very different than reporting people who have brain damage, isn't it?
People who are too impaired to drive a car get reported by the doctor here in California,
right,
to DMV, and they take their license until the doctor reevaluates them and says, okay,
right,
you're good to go. The only reason I mentioned DMV, the only reason I mentioned California law where narcotics are reported, and there's a good reason for them being reported, keeps patients from going to different doctor's offices and getting more narcotics. A doctor can check into the database and find out that another doctor is already prescribing narcotics. The only reason I mentioned those two things is because of the civil, rights thing. They're already in place. There's mechanisms that are already operating that make good sense. Why not do for people taking brain-altering psychiatric meds, which impairs your judgment and reasoning, has suicide in the black box, has anger, hostility, homicide? Why not do the same thing, but extend it beyond just reporting, and that report should go to sporting goods shops where this person cannot purchase a firearm until the doctor states, okay, they are no longer on these brain-altering medications. That's all I'm saying.
I understand what you're saying.
It should not be on gun control. It should be on psychiatric medication control. When you look at just about 100% of all the mass shooters are on psychiatric meds. And that's in my book.
I have
many of the shooters identified, and I identify the exact psychiatric meds they were on.
Yeah, you and I know about that. We're in agreement with that, obviously. But this is interesting, and if you don't mind, I want to explore why we can leave it. But I think it raises huge questions, what you're saying, and it should be thought about, but I think it's a little more extreme than you think, because the issue with motor vehicles is if you have somebody who you're afraid shouldn't be driving a car, you're a physician in many states, most, I'm not sure, you're obliged to report them to the
DMV, which may mean, of course, that I'll never see you again as a physician and not help from you. It's one of the binds we're in as physicians. But we don't just report them because they're brain injured, because we have many people who are driving who have one and safely with one compromise or another. And the issue then pertains to this, the huge problem of psychiatric drugs, because, you know, I suspect that half our population or more is at one time or another going to be on psych drugs now. I think it literally is. And if you put in narcotics, pain meds, prescription pain meds, it's probably 75% of our population. So you're talking about, first of all, a huge database which would inhibit most Americans from getting a gun. So I'm antsy about it. I think it's an interesting idea that doctors should report anybody who's too who's impaired from psych drugs. But again, it disrupts privacy issues of the physician-patient relationship. What I do love about what you're saying is to draw attention to the fact that of what you're calling drug control is a solution to gun crime than gun control. And I think that's a very good way to put it. I've not heard it put that way before, Bart. And I think it's a very, very important concept. But boy, it's a tangled issue once you start, you know, doing major interventions in people's lives. Any more thoughts on that, Bart? I'll give that to you to make some additional thoughts, and then we can go on to another subject.
Yeah. And now the only, you know, when I mentioned Chris Kyle, he was killed by a veteran who for a significant period of time was on brain-altering psychiatric meds prescribed through the VA, as well as illegal drugs. He was in and out of the VA. And I think if Chris Kyle, when he went to the VA, if you saw the movie, he did go to the VA and participate groups there. If the therapist at the VA, and they knew he was taking people out for so-called therapy to the shooting range, if I was the therapist and Chris Kyle was in the room with me with all these other patients, I would say, never take somebody on brain-altering medications to a shooting range where they could be a danger to themselves and you, and take them to play golf or tennis, but they are on brain-altering medications. If the therapist in that room said that to Chris Kyle, he would have been alive today.
I think that one of the things it reemphasizes for me is that we ought to hold physicians, prescribers, not even physicians, I think, for many of them, hold prescribers more and more liable for the acts of violence and suicide that they perpetrate under the influence of usually multiple psychiatric drugs, often just one. And, of course, I do that work, and I think you do some of that work, too, in the courts, where I have been an expert witness in against prescribers whose clients have or patients have committed suicide or harmed somebody under psych drugs. And quite often they've given signals. They've given signals that these drugs are doing negative effects, and they're not warning anybody. The prescribers are brushing it off, saying it's just a mental disorder, or raising the dose, or saying that'll pass, or it's got nothing to do with the drugs, and so on and so forth. I think the prescribers are at huge fault in this regard for buying the drug companies and the psychiatric establishments' propaganda about all this.
Yes.
We certainly share an enormous desire to cut back on drugs. And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, as you said before, I think, if ever and the government takes a look at this and all of the mass shooters being on psychiatric meds, or just about all of them, and they do something like this, our whole country would become aware of the significant adverse effects of antipsychotics and antidepressants. I don't really think they know. And I think a lot of general practitioners would know about this. So this would be a way of educating the country as to the adverse effects of these medications and what other approach would work. And what I advocate in my book is integrative treatment. Integrative treatment is many, many different kinds of treatments, ranging from counseling and peer counseling and biofeedback and guided imagery, yoga, et cetera. I list about 30 different ones, but that's not all of them in my book. So it would kind of force, you know, if somebody comes into a doctor's office, they said, I'm really feeling bad. You know, I lost my uncle. He died. We were very close. And the doctor decides, well, here's an antidepressant. And he knows about this one. He says, wait a minute, I'm a shooter. I can't take that stuff. I won't be able to shoot. I won't be able to have guns. What other kind of treatments are out there? Maybe that would spur people into looking what is more effective, dramatically more effective than psychiatric mind-altering medication.
Well, I'm sure it would have that effect. I'm not sure I'm willing to trade that much individual freedom for it. Let me remind folks who we're talking to. We're talking to my friend, my colleague, very respected by me for his work and by many, many others in the areas we're talking about, which are the subject of his book, Invisible Scars, How to Treat Combat Stress and PTSD Without Medication, a book that will be soon, in a few days, available on Amazon.com. And one of the interesting things about Bart, who is a PhD psychologist, one of the things I find interesting, is he actually joined the service in the enlisted ranks. And I think it's probably rather unusual that he actually retired as a medical service corps officer. He had a total of 34 years in the U.S. Army. Bart, pick up on what you'd like to talk about next. We have a lot. We can talk more about what happens to soldiers in the VA. We can talk about NFL, TBI.
Well, let's talk about something that when I saw the movie, let's talk about a movie that a lot of people are seeing. It's going to be nominated for Academy Award. And it's called Concussion. Will Smith starred in it. And I went to see it the day it opened because I was curious how they would treat the subject. And they did a very good job. Matter of fact, I called my editor and I said, I need to squeeze this into the book. It's a last-minute thing. And you know how editors are. It's like, well, the book's done. You can't put anything more in. I said, I got to put this in. And what happened is I went to see the movie, and this physician, he was a pathologist, neurological pathologist. He was working in Pittsburgh, and doing autopsies. And this football player came in, Pittsburgh Steelers football player, who was 50 years old, and he looked at him and he said, "Gee, you know, there has to be a reason that he was going off the deep end here, and that he died. His brain looks good on the scans. His heart looks good, but he died from a heart attack." And he said, I wanted to explore why this was going on with him. And the lab, obviously, the coroner's office, which was being run by somebody else, said no, because they were Pittsburgh Steelers fans, and they didn't want them messing with the star center. And Webster, his name was Webster. And so what happened is... he did it on his own dime. The doctor, the pathologist, did it on his own dime. And he paid for it. He paid $20,000 to get the lab test done. And he found with this player encephalopathy in his brain. And with that, an injury to the brain. And it's identified prior to the encephalopathy by what caused it. It can be caused by different things. But this one's chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a result of many impacts to the brain. So he did research on this guy, and he figured out that he had something like 70,000 impacts to his head over his career playing football. Now, he did not die, and the movie did not get into this aspect. It was wonderful what it did. It said CTE is a problem. The NFL was sued by the Players Association. They identified 6,000 players who would get benefits or retired, even though there's no active tests right now. They have to do it on an autopsy. They did. I get 6,000 players. The suit was for $1 billion. And that's about a third of all the retired football players. Now, there's a doctor out there who wants to develop a test for CTE, but the NFL wouldn't pay for that because if you have a test for it while a person's alive, then a lot of players are going to wind up who are playing discovering that they have a degree. And I feel 100% of all football players have a degree of CTE. It's the nature of the sport. I mean, you can't bang your head. It's subconcussive kinds of things where, you know, there's little tears and bleeds. That's why I say see the movie, it'll explain it very well. But what happened in the movie, I believe strongly that it probably did happen in real life. Webster came in to the team doctor's office in Pittsburgh complaining that, you know, he didn't know what was wrong with him. He was agitated, et cetera. The first thing the doctor did to calm him down is pull out a syringe of an antipsychotic Helgo and injected him. This was in the movie, and I believe this really did happen. I'm going to call the pathologist who now lives in California to confirm this, but they did not do anything in the movie talk about a tox screen, a screen for, you know, medication. The FDA states very clearly that Haldol should not be used as an injectable, and it states again very clearly in warnings, and again, it's on my website. You can see exactly where and go to the website, that the end results, the adverse effect from injecting Haldol is sudden cardiac death, and this football player died from cardiac death. He did not die from CTE. He died from a heart attack. That was not talked about in the movie. And here we go again, looking at the adverse reactions and the misuse of antipsychotic antidepressant medications. It's as clear as a nose on your face, as far as I'm concerned, why he had a heart attack.
Well, was there a time, I had the impression that he died of the heart attack quite a while after the Haldol injection. From what you were
saying,
or was it?
Well, in the movie, it depicted it like he died the next day.
Oh, okay. No, I just didn't know. Well, that certainly is possible. And of course, the irony is that if you take Haldol, you're on the road to another kind of encephalopathy that will be indistinguishable from chronic traumatic encephalopathy if you take the Haldol for a few years, because these drugs cause deterioration of the brain and dementia.
Yep.
It's a bizarre world we live in, this medical world right now.
Yeah, and what got me is that it was injected. And the FDA, I forget the date. I don't have my, I'm not at my office, but it gives the data. And I gave the date on the editorial and on my website when that warning was issued to not inject it.
I'm not even aware of that. I might be able to get a little chance to Google here. Don't want to mess up my Skype.
Just go on my website. I identify exactly where the web page is that I got that from.
And
I got
again,
it from
I'm talking with Bart
research.
Billings. Hey, Bart, how do people get in touch with you? Just go to your website?
Yeah, just go to Bart P. Billings. .com and look at the headings up above and go to editorial.
Good. Tell us more about your book. Did you have the sense that the NFL settlement was sufficient? I mean, I think it's been kind of controversial. They don't end up getting a lot of money. They're not getting billions each.
Right. Let's let's talk about settlements. Let's talk about what happened. Again, I want to talk about where people can go. And like I said, I did 3 editorials, and they're all current. And the last, the one that's first on the editorial list on the website is the case of a Marine who was being seen at the VA and committed suicide at an indoor firing range. Now, the couple agencies, one of the, you know, representing the veterans and a retired Marine General, General Brahms here in Carlsbad, California, they, for the past year, have been pestering the VA, requesting an investigation. The other group is called ACBOW, American Combat Veterans of War. They were pestering the VA here in La Jolla to investigate why this Marine, who was being treated there for 2 years, committed suicide. And they were able to get the Veteran Administration Inspector General to investigate it. The report came out in the San Diego Union-Tribune this past Sunday. The findings of the Inspector General, and the Inspector General stated basically that there was negligence. This person was treated with medications. Bottom line was standard of care was not adhered to. Now, that is similar, and I explain another case, and I was able to squeeze that in the book, actually, the last couple paragraphs of chapter 13. There's 13 chapters in the book. It's there explaining it, but it's also on the editorial part of the website. Now, about 2-3 years ago, I was visiting Pennsylvania, where I grew up, around the Scranton area, and there was a trial going on. And that trial, again, was a suit against the federal government, against the VA, by a Marine that lived in Carbondale, Pennsylvania. The trial was in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And the attorney representing the Marine was Jack Dempsey. And what they stated was that the standards of care were not adhered to in treating this Marine, which resulted in the Marine doing some really weird things, going to the pharmacy, stealing something. I mean, he just was kind of having all these adverse effects from the combination of psychiatric meds. The judge found in favor of the Marine with $3.7 million, and thank God the Marine did not die, that there was the standard care was violated, and he was basically medicated to the extent without any kind of supervision or whatever, follow-up, as the Marine here in San Diego was, except the Marine here in San Diego, and they didn't get to him in time. He wound up going to the shooting range and killing himself. So that case set the precedent in Scranton, Pennsylvania, and it shows that if you litigate, and I feel they have a pretty strong case here in San Diego, talking to General Brahms, who's an attorney. I think the wife has a very strong case, especially since the Inspector General found pretty much in her favor, stating that her husband was not treated correctly.
Yeah, I just think it's incredibly important. I'm astonished that a case against the VA could be won. Or did they settle? They settled, or they go to jury?
Usually, when they did the case back in Pennsylvania, it's heard by a federal judge, no jury.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean a jury. I meant to the judge. So it's actually the judge's finding rather than the settlement. And that's very good, because right now
the judge in Pennsylvania found in favor of the plaintiff, awarding them $3.7 million, and I don't know what the final settlement was, but it was in that range. And what was interesting, and I have the transcript, and I put some of the transcript in my book, and the attorney, and this is right from the transcript, for the government, for the VA, for the Department of Justice, basically said to the judge in that case, judge, if you rule in favor of the plaintiffs, you're going to open the floodgates.
Right.
And the plaintiff's attorney jumped all over the DOJ attorney and said, how dare you? How dare you try to intimidate the judge saying we're going to open the floodgates? Can you repeat it? Open the floodgates? Are you kidding? And the judge found in favor of the plaintiff. He was not going to allow that type of intimidation.
Well, I think that's wonderful. Maybe unusual and maybe special. Bart, as best as I can tell, you know, I didn't think that there's anything that to prevent doctors from injecting Haldol. You know, it's sold with an injectable in an injectable form, and there's nothing to prevent doctors from doing it. But you're certainly right that it can cause heart attack and sudden unexpected death and heart attack. There's no doubt at all about that. And the more vulnerable the individual is, the older, or if they have any heart disease, the more likely that's going to happen. But sudden death from drugs can occur almost any time, and certainly giving it to it intravenously, because the impact is dramatic and instantaneous, is an even greater threat to both the brain and the cardiovascular system.
When you go to the movie, if you go see Concussion, I was sitting there with a friend of mine, and when this doctor injected Hall, I said, all right, I spoke out loud. I usually don't do this. And I said, are you kidding me? You know, but they never really got back to that. You basically said he died from cardiac arrest, but they gave the impression that he died from CTE, which CTE didn't.
Yeah. I haven't seen the movie. I'm astonished. I plan to. I'm astonished that they would actually mention the drug by name. Interesting to know, you may not remember, whether they said Haldol or Haloperidol. I doubt if they used a proprietary name, but maybe they did. Do you remember?
No.
Yeah, probably Haloperidol, I guess. But, wow, you know, it's getting out to the world more and more that psychiatric drugs are damaging, and your work is one of the reasons it's getting more and more out in the world. How long have we known each other? I'm trying to think. Do you remember when I first came to your conference and met you and gave a presentation? And
it had to be 10 years ago.
Yeah, I think it's probably like 10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah.
It was before you went to such great effort to get the Veterans Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives to have me present to them.
That committee actually sprouted. We've had a lot of high-ranking military and congressional people attend the conference. It is the longest-running conference in the world on combat stress, and it's for military and civilians because there's so many civilians working with our veterans. And the congressman was the chairman of the Congressional Veterans Committee, and he came 2 years in a row, and I pestered him for 2 years to hold hearings. And part of what pushed him into doing the hearings is that I gave him a copy of your book, Medication Madness. And he flew back to Washington from San Diego on the plane and read the book. I had it all underlined because I read it. And he gave it back to me, so that was good to this day. And that was in 2010. That book has not been returned. So it's sitting on a shelf or somebody's shelf. And it's all outlined, all underlined in red and yellow, all of the things that you described. But he came back and he said, okay, we're going to have hearings. And that's the first time hearings like that happened. To investigate the relationship between psychiatric medication and suicide in the military. And we got you to testify. I testified. Commander Barber, who's an attorney, Navy commander, he testified. And we all basically said, what's going on? You know, we said that there's a strong relationship. From 2005 to 2011, there's been a 700% increase in the amount of psychiatric medications purchased by the Department of Defense. And if you look at the suicide rate, it goes up. And, you know, after, you know, there for a few years, there are more suicides in the military than there were deaths in battle in Afghanistan. So, you know, it was all clear that the hearings went, I felt, well, of course, the psychiatry was there and the pharmaceuticals were there. And I figured that Congress didn't do much about it after the hearings, but at least the word got out. You know, if you want to read it, it's February 24, 2010, congressional hearings, relationship between psychiatric meds and suicide, the military. But what happened is last June, I received an email, and again, the Congressional Committee, the Veterans Congressional Committee, is investigating the relationship between psychiatric meds and suicide in the VA. So it's like, okay, it took you 5 years to get around to it, but they're doing that now. I sent questions for the hearing. They said they're going to have further hearings. I haven't heard when they are, but it was astonishing watching that hour and a half hearing how the leaders of the VA would not really give Congress the answers to their questions. And so Congress explained to them that they're entitled to these answers and gave them time to put it together. Again, I have a summary because I did a summary of my observations of the hearings. And it was amazing. The congressmen were very, very concerned about the well-being of our veterans. I was impressed how caring they were. But on the other hand, the representatives of the VA were doing more or less the survival, escape, and evasion that you learn in the Army. They were debating, and, you know, an hour and a half, it's hard to get anything done. But hopefully those hearings will continue and something will be done. But obviously, it didn't help this Marine who killed himself since that happened a while ago. So maybe something's happening.
I really appreciate you keeping up with all of this. I didn't even know about that might be holding hearings again. So please send that information on to me. I'll tell you tell the folks a funny story about the hearings. I didn't know what the hearings were going to do. I mean, I had the impression that everybody got 3 minutes. And when I got there...
People listening want to know about these hearings in June, again, I explained it all in the book, what the hearings were, where they were held, and what was said during the hearings, some of the questions that were asked, and some of the questions I propose that they ask next time around.
Yeah, and I have the complete hearings, the original complete hearings, which start out with a half hour, the original complete hearings are on my website, so you can see the video of the entire hearings, including BS from the VA and also BS from the American Psychiatric Association and so on. But when I walked into these hearings, I thought I was going to be one of these three-minute presenters, and I was told I was going first. So I sat down and looked at my notes, and a woman who was in charge of the hearing came over to me and said, "You have only 3 minutes, sir." I said, "Well, okay, I was hoping for a little more, but that's fine." And then Congressman himself came down, and he stopped her, and he said just what you had said, Bart. He said, "I'm holding these hearings because of your book. You take as much time as you want." So if you watch the hearing, you'll see that I start out with a well-prepared 3 minutes,
And then I go basically to a scientific paper, which fortunately I had written, inspired by the hearings. I did an update on all these issues, which was then published in the International Journal of Risk and Safety in Medicine. So I was able to go from my carefully prepared 3 minutes to then using the paper to take the committee through a great detail. I never thought I'd live to see the day where I went to a hearing where I started out with half an hour and the VA got 10 minutes and the APA got 10 minutes. It was very, very gratifying. And I'm glad to hear, Bart, and, you know, keep me up with it, and that they're thinking about holding hearings again. We've got probably about 7 or 8 minutes to go. I want to make sure we get to talk about, you know, all the things that are of interest to you. You've been doing so much in this field. Or maybe tell us a little bit about the resistance you've run into, because everybody who does your work, or my work, I mean, you've run into tremendous resistance with your conference over the years. I don't know if you'd like to talk about that.
Yeah, it's amazing how the conference developed. I was a commanding officer of a general hospital section during the first Persian Gulf War, and people were called to duty, and they were sent all over the world. They weren't sent as a one hospital, which was not a good idea. But a lot of people came back with various problems. You train with people, you should send them as a unit, but they didn't. They didn't learn their lesson from Vietnam, where that took place as well. But when people came back, they had all kind of problems. So we decided to do a conference and put together a readiness protocol. And we did. It was called a HART program, Human Assistance Rapid Response Team. And again, the complete HART, people can download it from the website. You can actually download it and use it, and the whole HART protocol is in one of the chapters in the book. Well, we developed the HART protocol, and we had various speakers every year. We decided we're going to do a yearly conference to make sure people learn about how to be ready for deployment. And then we decided we're going to recommend different kind of treatment modalities prior and after they get back, et cetera, et cetera. Over the 22 years, the conference evolved and identified the dangers of psychiatric medications, both for the soldiers when they get home and on the battlefield. And they started probably around 2004 or so, giving people 160 day supply of brain-altering psychiatric meds to take with them when they get deployed in the combat. That never happened before. And so we saw all of the adverse reactions, the soldiers coming back from combat saying people were like zombies. They didn't know whether they were coming or going. And we realized over 22 years that integrative treatment was the treatment of choice, not only for our combat vets, preferred the general population, people who are having emotional problems, whatever. Integrative treatment, which, like I said, can go anywhere from the counseling to guided imagery to yoga to Pilates, et cetera. And an integrative treatment program was the most effective way of dealing with emotional problems. What happened when this came up, the 15th year of the conference, I had some psychiatrists, military psychiatrists, saying, if you don't change the subject, we are going to boycott the conference. We're going to tell people not to come. It never happened. We still have people coming. But very few psychiatrists come to it because psychiatrists, you have to understand, and you know this, Peter, that 90-some percent of psychiatrists' primary treatment modality is psychiatric brain-altering medications. I was told by one of the VA clinics here in San Diego County by a psychiatrist, a chief psychiatrist. I asked him specifically how many of his patients does he medicate. He told me 98%. That's disgraceful. So they... More, I don't think psychiatry and the pharmaceutical companies care too much for me because I've been exposing this for many years. But I've been exposing it because other people who come to the conference, from all over the world they come to this conference, are all saying the same thing.
You do great work. Another thing that Bart and I have done together that may be of interest to some listeners, we both have chapters in a recent book, a 2014 book, called The Attorney's Guide to Defending Veterans in Criminal Court. The Attorney's Guide to Defending Veterans in Criminal Court. I've got a chapter on TBI, PTSD, and psychiatric drugs, a perfect storm for causing abnormal mental states and aberrant behavior. And Bart, you have an overview chapter on the overdrugging of people and the veterans and soldiers in that book, as I recall.
Yeah, I do. Matter of fact, in my book coming out next week, I did take excerpts from what you said in the book and put them in my book. As you know, I mean, I called you up and asked you if I can do it, and I did. So there's kind of a summary of the chapter in the book that you wrote in my coming out book.
No, that's great. That's great. Well, I hope you and I will be able to, you know, get together and keep on doing stuff. Maybe we can, you know, I'm not traveling much these days, and this is really important, but I'd certainly go to Washington with you to take them on at another hearing in the future. That would be a grand event indeed. It's really been quite a difficult task, this confronting the military and the veterans and getting them to change. They make little changes. I think they've come out with a memo that SSRIs aren't the treatment of choice for PTSD, something like that. But God, you know, it'd be really interesting to some whistleblower could tell us who's at the top of the VA and the military who's been getting paid off to do things like give 180-day supplies of Seroquel, an antipsychotic drug, to 18-year-old men to carry with them as a pack that's renewable with no supervision into combat. I mean, it's such craziness. There's got to be something up at the top where they just found the right person, the drug companies, and opened the sleuth. Because, as you so well know, it's only in the Iraq War that we begin allowing soldiers to go into combat on psych drugs. And yet, during the Iraq War, soldiers began to be told they had to go in with drugs. Folks, Bart P. Billings, PhD, my guest, his new book, Invisible Scars, How to Treat Combat Stress and PTSD Without Medication. Bart, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Peter.